It has been a year since the world's attention was drawn to the food and nutritional crisis affecting the Sahel region of Africa. $1.2 billion was provided in assistance to around 10 million people across eight countries to help avert a humanitarian catastrophe. But according to the World Food Programme, millions of people in the region are still affected by drought, with close to 1.5 million children under the age of five at risk of severe acute malnutrition. Meanwhile, the conflict in Mali has triggered widespread displacement in the region, uprooting 500,000 people and placing pressure on communities still recovering from drought. Jesuit Father Peter Balais has recently returned from the Sahel region, where he saw at first-hand efforts to accommodate those who have had to flee their country. He spoke to Lydia O'Kane about the importance of education in rebuilding lives.
It was this time last year that it came to the world's attention that there was serious humanitarian situation in the Sahel, coupled with drought and a food situation. You have recently visited the Sahel. What news do you feel you're bringing back? Are you bringing back a positive view 1 year on of what's been happening in the Sahel?
I have been in Chad, and the Jesuit Refugee Service is working in Chad since 7 years, with refugees from Sudan, Darfur, and also internally displaced people. And we are working also on the other side of the border in Sudan, Sudan North, Darfur, since several years. And then I've been also in Central Africa. The answer to your question of 1 year later, if the news are better, is not so simple to answer, because the issues are complex and of long periods, the developments and crisis. So let me touch on a few things. If you look at the Sahel, I talk from the perspective of Chad, but reading a bit about the other countries, the events, the refugees from Sudan, that's a bit the background from where I try to highlight a few aspects of the complexity of the Sahel as a region which goes across Africa, from West Africa, you know, Mali, Niger, North Nigeria, Chad, North Sudan or Sudan, and right into the Horn of Africa, you know, Eritrea and so on. It's, of course, it is first of all an ecologically volatile area, and you mentioned the drought. They told me in Abishe in East Chad this year the rainy season was better, and but it's, you know, 1 year is this way, next is the other way. The overall general trend is the Sahara Desert is moving southwards. You know, you have, and you can link it with global warming. And that means that populations move from, you know, ahead of the desert. Like, take the population in Darfur. The more the pastoralists, the camel riders, you know, they move towards the mountains of Darfur because there's more rain, there's more water. So that's one layer of the problem, the desertification, and I guess analysts link it with the global warming. And then the cause for displacement and conflict. You have another layer in the Sahel, which runs across, is very fragile governments. You know, just let's recall a bit in Chad 5 years ago, around this time in February, a big column of 100 or 200 land cruisers with heavily armed rebels moved very quickly from Darfur, from Sudan, towards N'Djamena, reached N'Djamena, almost toppled the government. They're the president, but with the help of the French Air Force and so, the government survived. Today the government is stable, they have oil, Chad is stable, it is advancing, and the displaced people return home. But it was 5 years ago. You have Mali, just the last few months. You had, also take Cote d'Ivoire, the conflict in Cote d'Ivoire, the Ivory Coast. The political fight for power is also a fight of the northern area of people from the north, which is more savanna, not Sahel, but savanna, and Islamic. In the south is forest land and rich and traditional African and Christian kind of setting, cultural setting. So they have that conflict there. So that runs across the Sahel, the instability of governments. Even if you take, you know, the rebel activities in Darfur, which continues, the refugees told me, we do not want to go back. They're there already almost 9 years, 9, 10 years from Darfur, and they say more people are coming, not in big numbers, but they said there are many more displaced people at the border with Chad. And why? This, the refugees express it that way. There's a conflict between the white Arabs and the black Arabs, the way they call it, or the camel owners and the pastoralists, the cow owners, or the agriculturalists. So you have that, again, the economic conflict. And then on top of it, there's gold found in Darfur. That's what they say, the mountains of Darfur. So if there are resources, there's another reason to fight for and also to feed and sustain the war. Then you have another level, which is also clear, we need to speak about it, the cultural and religious kind of line or kind of conflict line, if you want, or potential conflict line. In Chad, it's peaceful. Yeah, but you also need to understand the images. I used recently some in a Facebook communication, the two images, walking out of the church in Abeshe, and there was still the singing and the drums and the people and, you know, modern instruments also, and young people, children, girls, but the whole family, the mixture of a community. And 2 days before, on a Friday prayer, after the prayer in Gerida, just solemnly man walking from the mosque home, you know. Not to play the one thing against the other, but it is a reality. It's a reality the way people live. And you have these are more the southerners in charge who are more Christians, and in the middle and the northern part are more Muslim. And so they live together peacefully. But if you get groups like Boko Haram from Nigeria who say everything Western is bad, very quickly you can have a divide. If you have people who radicalize either this or that religion, or you can have also Christian fundamentalists, but at the moment it is groups like Boko Haram or Al-Qaeda in Mali or the Salafist kind of Wahhabist theological school sponsored a lot by Saudi Arabia, which has influence, is gaining influence in some countries. Then you have very quickly a very volatile situation where people live together peacefully, what the case is in Chad, and you can have very quickly a kind of a northern Nigeria. I was told there was a group already, a house in Jamena, which is just across from Nigeria and Cameroon, you know, the capital of Chad, with a community of Boko Haram. Government acted quickly. They don't want that there. Jesuits in Cameroon told me a lot of military has been put up to the north. There's a small minority of Muslim population. Not a problem, but influence zone of Boko Haram, and the government in Cameroon does not want that. So that's, you have that conflict which happens in Nigeria and Kano, where the Christian minority is being driven out, churches are burned because of radicalization of religion, is an issue, is a reality, and can get bigger, you know. And also reading about Mali, that Mali was very early on a secular state and tried to be a secular state, but also there's a growing Islamization, and that creates then different lines. So you have in the Sahel these different layers or lines of conflict lines or very volatile lines, the cultural, the ecological, like the desertification, then of course also the political, and the influence zone. I mean, there are, wherever there are resources, like, okay, in Chad it's oil, so they keep big interests of the international community, but also a lot of China presence. But also take a country like Central Africa, which is south of Chad. The rebels which moved recently from the northeast towards Bangui, the capital city, got support by the rebels from Darfur. So there is also that kind of, and people said, yeah, there's an Islamist influence and interest in that to change the government in Bangui. And that goes right into kind of more the central part of Africa, which is normal, you know.
The situation, just going back to just the point of Mali and the conflict, I mean, when you were there, what were you hearing about Mali, and what was the situation with, you were talking about there were some, obviously, people fleeing, maybe not as much as before, but it's still happening that people are trying to escape.
I mean, Africa's very big, and between Jamina and Bamako, that's probably 2,000 kilometers to fly. There's Niger in between, so it is a big distance. But so we didn't get, in that sense, refugees from Mali. But we were told by the UN in east of Chad to be very careful in the northern camps, which are more the northern part of the east, follow carefully the security instructions, in order not to take any risk, because there was said groups, split off groups, or you know, people from the Mali rebel movement are moving across the Sahara, the Sahel, along that line towards Sudan and places, and they create instability, and that can mean, you know, for foreign nationals to be at risk for hostage taking, you know, and in that sense, there is a kind of an effect on. But in general, the government in charge is very stable. But also, of course, let's be clear, the French troops are there and have a clear interest to keep that government stable in there. So, in order to avoid further destabilization in along that.
It's an ongoing thing. It's not
sure. I mean, if you see the land, yes, the land can sustain the local population, which, you know, some few fields when there's rain, but to grow sorghum and this dry cereals, but they have a lot of kind of animals, goats and camels. But there is, of course, a problem when you have an over-herding and over the number too big, then you deplete also the environment. So how many people and animals can that Sahel zone support? And you have suddenly a population of 300,000 somewhere, but then they cannot live on that, on top of it, on that land, which is anyway already very scarce for the local population.
You made an interesting point there. You were saying that some refugees, was it Sudan, that didn't actually want to go back. How hard is that when you've refugees coming constantly fleeing and wanting to go to camps, and then people who are not maybe leaving? Is that a difficulty?
No, I mean, the refugee camps, the main number of the people have come in 2003, 4, 5, in these years, when at the peak of the Darfur crisis. So they are settled there now. They built their humble earth houses, you know, and so on. The camp is composed by these houses and traditional houses with walls around, and they get the food from there. There are schools there. There's infrastructure in the camps. Nothing extraordinary, but it's there. It's functioning. So they rather prefer that life than being in an insecurity at home.
What about the psychological impact of fleeing a conflict zone when you're a refugee, kind of into the camps? Is that ever addressed?
Sure, there are impacts. What people see, the trauma they have gone through, of course, that's an issue. then when they stay longer, the kind of, you know, loss of perspective, of hope. And the third thing I would say is to expect everything, you know, kind of a dependency. I even addressed them recently when they gave me a long list, you know, whenever a head of an organization comes, they always, people tend to give you the list, and this we need, and this we need, and this we need, and this we need. And, you know, as I said, you know, there are already many things are being done, you know. It's good also to mention that and not just giving always, as if we, like a God, come and can solve all these issues, you know. But it shows this kind of having become so dependent and only expecting the solution always from the others and being unhappy when the solution doesn't come, you know. Instead of saying also, we do that and you can help us with that, you know, it sounds better. So that is a phenomenon. Of course, how do we address the despair or the loss of perspective? And that's education. Education and again, education, education. It's for the children to go to school. And I do think they have probably better schooling gradually than what they have at home. And that, having got schooling, education, is a factor for the future. You know, that gives hope. And now what we need to address together with UNHCR and GRS, we manage around schools for 60,000 children in all the camps, teaching training the teachers. But it's an uphill struggle. There are not many skills available. And that's where you realize the lack of education is a big indicator of the poverty. So I would name that also a fourth kind of cause, root cause of a volatile state, society, and conflictive society, when the level of education is so low that they don't have proper leadership, you know.
So is that something people were trying to address, the education issue? Did you note that?
Yeah, we try to, as I said, we manage for 60,000 children the schools and train the teachers for 12 camps, and try to upgrade them. You need to imagine somebody who has gone out of secondary school is becoming a primary school teacher or even a secondary school teacher for the first year. You know, that's the indicator of the lack of trained people. So to invest in that, we're exploring new ways of doing that, perhaps even with online learning, to train quickly the coming years capable people, teachers, and other skills, because that people will take home. Either, you know, even now in the camp, they use it for the life now, or they'll take it home, you know, and build up Darfur one day with some better ideas and ideas of fighting, you know.
I just wanted to ask you, I mean, more often than not, refugees, immigrants go to a place that's not their own, and they're not always welcomed with open arms. How did you find that when you were in the Sahel in Chad? Was there a sense that they were welcomed, or did you find anything like that at all?
Yeah, it's not that sense of that they are not welcomed. You know, it is as a big space, so it is all for us pretty much desert and dry, but it's a big space, so these refugees, in a way, bring even in, you know, economic activities. You think there would be so much money in the east of Chad, in Abyssinia and the border, when there were not international organizations and salaries. And so, of course, they distort the local market prices and all that. But in reality, also money comes in and some infrastructure, and that part of Chad is connected. So I would say there is a lot of benefit in having refugees around. And I think it's also important to say the borders are borders of the colonial time. They cut through populations who have been always together. And that's why we need to go back years and centuries. The Sahel has been the route of transport of the caravans to Mecca for the pilgrimage. Along the Sahel, the Islam spread in northern Africa into the central parts of Africa. It's normal, you know, these kind of borders between Sudan and Chad are colonial borders. So for the people, it's the same culture and it's not so different.
You hear the phrase, we're in it for the long haul. It does seem that way in the Sahel. It's not an issue. It's not something that it's going to be, you click your fingers and it goes away. It's going to be a lengthy process.
Absolutely not. We are going to have now here a meeting of our advocacy people and from the Middle East and somebody with expertise in Mali to reflect together about North Africa and Middle East and its, you know, impact in terms of population flow and Europe. Because Europe can say, these are big problem areas. It's reality at the doorsteps of Europe. And nobody can deny that. But it's a question, how do we deal with that? How do we deal with this conflict, if even Syria and so on, but also with the other area? Because one thing is also clear, the Sahara, having been always a trade route for the slave trade, becomes now a major route of trafficking people. And trafficked people are like the modern slaves, modern enslaved prostitutes and all that. That's happening. Through that, cocaine is transferred from South America via Mali. And it's proven now over the last years, it's proven that goes to Mali in the airstrips, and then it goes in by road to Europe and so on, and to the Mediterranean. So that whole area, what happens there is impacting. Also, we think there's a big desert in between. No, that desert is not, so one can cross it, is impacting on Europe, and we need to think about it, how to deal with it. And that's where, say, it's not a stable zone because of the various factors, and it's at the doorsteps of Europe. And from us, of course, it's always, no matter who people are, from our perspective as a Christian and as a refugee organization, the protection of people who need protection, who are vulnerable, who are refugees, needs to be guaranteed in any solution or political kind of dealing with this complex reality.
Pope Benedict XVI last year made an appeal for the Sahel region. He's made appeals throughout his pontificate in areas where there's been conflict, in areas where there's been humanitarian crisis. How important have his words been over the course of his pontificate, do you think?
They are important because, first of all, people are not forgotten. And people of any culture or religious background, the concern, our Christian concern for people in great need, and I think that's what the Catholic Church and the Pope express with that, the embracing love of Christ, you know, for suffering humanity. But of course it's also very important, again and again, to appeal for peaceful solutions. You know, it's so easily now, and as you see in Syria, yes, people wanted changes, but not that it leads to that violence. Do we, you know, one welcomes the changes in North Africa, but the violence doesn't serve anyone. And that's where the message of the Pope, the non-violent message, you know, is so important, because very few people speak that message.